I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Well, we ain't killing their army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Bonnie Christian. She is a fellow at Defense Priorities and weekend editor at The Week. Her writing has also appeared at Time Magazine, CNN, Politico, USA Today, The LA Times, The American Conservative, and on like that. Here she is at Reason Magazine. If Trump isn't planning to draw down U.S. intervention in Somalia, he should be. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Listen, I've been a big fan of your writing for a long time. And
Thank you.
To it all the time at antiwar.com, and I'm not sure why I haven't had you on the show before, but happy to have the chance to.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
And also, I owe you thanks because I had missed the NBC article that you caught and wrote about here. Very important stuff. So tell us about that first.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it was super interesting. Basically, NBC reported that the Trump administration was planning to draw down this escalation in Somalia that started at the very tail end of the Obama administration and then really kicked into high gear during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And so we had quotes from unnamed officials saying, not every nasty character out there is a threat to the U.S. Do we want to do the Somali government's job for it? And then another one said that the Al-Shabaab militants, who are the primary target in Somalia, are really a parochial issue and not a direct threat to the United States. And so that seemed to suggest that there was going to be this sort of de-escalation, drawdown, maybe an American exit from Somalia. And that came out, I believe, on a Friday. And then by the following Monday, the Pentagon has a statement pushing back saying, you know, there's no policy changes and we're going to stay and continue supporting the Somali government's efforts against Al-Shabaab.
And I guess nobody ever got a quote out of Trump himself about this so far, huh?
Yeah, I don't believe there was anything from Trump or any of the, big name defense or security officials. No one that we would really recognize ever went on the record about it. It was just sort of these unnamed officials speaking to NBC and then this generic statement from the Pentagon saying, no, nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was last summer that the Washington Post had a story, should be easy enough to find, because it ends with Mattis telling Trump, you have no choice, when Trump is complaining about Somalia and saying, why are we even in Somalia? You could just imagine him going, where's Somalia? Who cares about Somalia? How could a local insurgency in Somalia possibly be of concern to me? You know, that kind of attitude. And they told him, in fact, I think the quote was, well, we're doing it to prevent a bomb going off in Times Square, or a nuclear bomb even, or something like that. Like, yeah, okay. Doesn't quite add up. In fact, the only time there was an attack on Times Square, luckily it was a failed one, but it was in direct reaction to the drone war in Pakistan. Otherwise, I haven't had too many of those.
Yeah, and I believe and I'd want to check to make sure I'm getting the numbers right, but I believe it's the case that it's either 3 decades or I want to say it's 4 decades that since there's been an attack on American soil by anyone, any Somali-born terrorist. So it's this idea that these unnamed officials were saying that this is something of a local parochial issue. Really is borne out by the last several decades of our interactions with Somalia.
Yeah. Well, and it seemed like if it was an experiment to see if you could provoke a Somali American into committing a terrorist attack, in the name of, you know, whatever the war going on in the Middle East, then this kind of intervention would be the way to provoke that rather than the way to prevent that kind of thing. Otherwise, how's Al-Shabaab supposed to hit Minnesota unless it's a citizen already living there?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the case that I think with any intervention like this, that the risk of unintended consequences is real and is something that is too often ignored or downplayed with this sort of, we have to fight them over there so we don't fight them over here argument. It would be, you know, maybe nice if it was that tidy, if fighting over there guaranteed that there would be nothing bad happening over here. But the reality is often much messier.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure if it's just public relations. I guess it's more like the two faces of Donald Trump here, where you know he knows better, but at the same time, he has that whole ethic of just being tough and kicking butt and unleashing the military, if for no other reason, so that politically speaking, no one can ever accuse him of tying their hands, right? He wants to delegate to them enough power to win any battle so that no one can blame him for their defeats, of which they have plenty. But it's like he just as soon doubled down. In fact, he sent infantry to Somalia. Because you said, he's escalated Obama's war, well, really Bush and then Obama's war there. Mm-hmm. Before there was Special Operations Command and CIA, now there's actual infantry on the ground. I don't know if they're fighting or well, they must be, not just training, right? That would be the Rangers or whoever training.
Yeah, my understanding is, so sort of the modern intervention in Somalia starts in 2007, but it's pretty low key, like two or three airstrikes a year up until 2016, 2017. And so then Trump comes into office and in early 2017, he designates parts of Somalia, these areas of active hostility, which means that military operations can proceed with less oversight and with less care for avoiding civilian casualties. And so it's in, I want to say, like, as of the beginning of 2017, you still only have about 50 American boots on the ground there. And then that quickly increases to about the 500 that there are today. And the airstrikes increase as well. So in 2017, I want to say there were around 25 or 30 airstrikes. And then last year, around 50. So it's escalated considerably under Trump. And I think you're right. It's pretty typical of this sort of internal division in how he approaches foreign policy so inconsistently, where he does have at times these good impulses of saying, you know, we shouldn't police the world. Why are we in these places that I don't care about, that I haven't heard of? We should come home from there. But at the same time, he has this very militaristic, very like gleeful approach to the idea of bombing places and deploying the military. And he loves the excitement and the military show. And so it makes for a lot of inconsistency. And then when you add in advisors who do tend to be on the interventionist side, I think any of those better impulses toward peace just get totally smothered.
Yeah. He's just frustrated that there's never an end with a parade. It's always this ongoing quagmire here, there, and everywhere else. And he kind of, I think Tom Engelhart wrote one time about how they're just of the same generation and they just grew up on World War II in a way that you can tell he's stuck in that kind of thinking, that the leader of the bad guys should sign the piece of paper saying he quits and then that should be the end of it. And then we move on from there and we can have peacetime again or something like that. And so instead it's just more troops, pull some out, put some back in. I don't know. It goes on forever.
Yeah, it's difficult because I think it's just because of how much of this is sort of seems to be sort of his unconscious mindset and, you know, what he enjoys as opposed to like anything really carefully thought out or any systematic idea of how American foreign policy should work or the purpose of the military. It just ends up very messy and inconsistent and a continuation of sort of the last, the two previous administrations' policies of just intervening, you know, here, there, and everywhere, and never really ending anything.
Hey guys, check out Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. It's everything you need to be an educated libertarian. You may be long out of college and you have a family and a job, but you really want to know this stuff. Well, they got all of these classes on history, economics, and libertarian theory, and all of these things. Great professors and wonderful credentialed libertarians, essentially teaching college-level classes about everything you need to know. Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Follow through from the link in the right-hand margin on my page at scotthorton.org. I wonder, too, whether James Mattis ever told him. I mean, the Washington Post version is protect us from terrorist attack. But I wonder if Mattis ever said that, you know, this is as George W. Bush would have said about strategery. We got to make sure we're there so that we can keep China out or less relevant in the area. And it's the gates of the Bab al-Mandeb straight there, the opening of the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden there. So it's, you know, somehow it wasn't necessary before, but now it's necessary and forever that we have a beachhead there, right? But I wonder if they ever even told him that, or if they still, they just threatened him with something exploding somewhere.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Somalia is interesting in this regard because, of course, it's, you know, long been extremely poor, extremely chaotic, frequently used as like a punchline for libertarians, like, you know, oh, if you want less government, why don't you go live in Somalia? But they have, you know, this very long, strategically important coastline. They also have these probable untapped oil reserves, and they're in a, you know, a key place in the world. So, yeah, it's you know, certainly we can't know, but it's not hard to see sort of the more interventionist Washington foreign policy establishment thinking this is a good place for us to have a long-term troop presence for strategic purposes. Yeah. Of course, they're, you know, not going to bring up all of the attendant risks and ways that that could draw us into a much broader war, much broader conflicts that we do not need or want.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's worth mentioning, too, you talked about how the war broke out really at the beginning of 2007 and into 2006 there with the Ethiopian invasion, which the Americans sponsored and helped plan, and the CIA and Special Operations Command helped with the attack and everything at the beginning there. But that was all in reaction to this Islamic Courts Union that al-Shabaab was the smallest and least influential member of, and which itself had grown up in reaction to American support for various warlords, including the son of Adid, the bad guy from Black Hawk Down. He was in the CIA's employ, and it was really in reaction to that, that the Islamic Courts Union kind of federal government, in a sense, came into being there at all. And then it was only the war and the invasion of the Christmas 2006, the beginning of 07 there by Ethiopia, the USA-Ethiopia invasion there, that even made al-Shabaab into something important. Because at that point, they were, you know, al-Shabaab means the youth, right? So they were the ones who were doing the fighting. The rest of the Islamic Courts Union were, you know, essentially marginalized, and they became the leaders of the resistance against the foreign invasion. So that was what inflated all of their power, was right there, you know, in the middle of the George W. Bush years. It wasn't like he came because of that. He created that.
Yeah, and I mean, you can even, I think, look further back and look at the Cold War era, where, you know, both the United States and the Soviet Union are sending in weapons to try to keep for the military dictatorship's affections, which, of course, contributes to the chaos. And then when the Cold War ends and the dictatorship breaks down, then we get into that intervention that leads to the Black Hawk Down situation. And so it's just at this point decades of intervention that's had in many cases, these negative consequences, and that has contributed to the situation we find today. But of course, we tend to you know, ignore or at least not bother to sort through and understand that recent history. And so then it just becomes, well, there's these bad guys in Somalia, you know, they're doing bad things, and they are doing, I mean, al-Shabaab does these terrible, you know, suicide bombings that kill hundreds of civilians at a time. And so it says, so we say, well, let's go in there and try to fix this. But the track record of us going into Somalia and trying to fix things is not good and has not been good for a long time.
Yeah. Now, so back to the NBC story, it sort of makes sense that somewhere inside the White House, some small group of people on the National Security Council somewhere or maybe just Donald Trump himself, has the idea that, hey, we could close down Syria, Afghanistan, and then why not go for a third one? And that, you know, they floated this. This was some kind of trial balloon, I guess, to NBC by, you know, I don't know which faction or if the NBC story really implied if this was Jared Kushner or if this was John Bolton or where this came from. Probably not the latter there, but it's interesting that they even brought this up, right? That, I mean, assuming NBC didn't just make the story up out of whole cloth.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to say, and I mentioned this in the Reason article, like, what exactly is going on here? Was this really something that was being seriously considered? Was it, you know, maybe there were some tentative discussions that some people misinterpreted as this is definitely happening? Did NBC just get it wrong? But I think because of the pattern that we've seen with Syria and Afghanistan, which you mentioned, where there's sort of this move to withdraw frequently from Trump himself, though, of course, not in this case. And then there's this rather quick backtracking where it becomes a slow withdrawal or it becomes we're only going to leave Syria if we get this very unlikely promise from Turkey or, you know, if we take troops out of Syria, they're not going to come home. They're going to go to Iraq. It seems like that there's a strong chance that what's happening with the Somalia story is similar, where there was a real move by the president or possibly by some of his advisors to say, let's leave Somalia. And then that got reported. And then it very quickly got overpowered by, you know, other voices in the administration who do not want to leave.
Yeah. You know, it's funny to see even much lower down the chain of command type generals like in Afghanistan refute the president essentially and tell the newspaper on the record that I ain't got no orders. We're not leaving. That's just rumors in the news and this kind of thing. Pretty brave of them. I mean, even assuming that's true, which it sounds unfortunately true, seems like they could kind of say no comment or be a little bit more diplomatic. They're in the chain of command under the president, after all. But they just seem perfectly comfortable to contradict him and say, we're not leaving Somalia. I don't know who told you that, but it ain't true in this kind of reaction.
I mean, in practice, it's sort of understandable why they would feel comfortable speaking that way, right? Because of the pattern that they've seen with Syria and Afghanistan. You know, as much as Trump does sometimes talk a good talk about leaving, he seems very easily persuaded to not follow through with that. And so just given that pattern, at this point, I would say, you know, if you're in that position, perhaps it doesn't feel like a huge risk to come out and say, you know, no, to our knowledge, we're not leaving. Whatever you've heard, that those rumors may be going around, but it's probably not going to happen.
Yeah. You know, the problem is he really needs the political advice that this would be a great way to get reelected, that we have so many wars that he could end a war every few months from now until election day, and he'd be Trump the Great by then. And he would, you know, in the perfect judo maneuver, would force the Democrats to attack him from the Dick Cheneyite position that, no, you can never withdraw from anywhere. That's what the people want, and that's not what the people want.
Yeah, I hope that would be true, that if that if he left with, you know, ended these wars, that would be a election-winning thing. The more cynical side of me, though, wants to say that because there's so much in the background, especially things like Somalia, where it doesn't have the prominence of in Afghanistan, Syria, or Iraq, that it's just so little on people's minds and has so little effect on our daily lives that it might not be met with as much enthusiasm as we'd want for those wars to be ended. Like I said, this is the more cynical side of me, and I hope that it would produce sort of the reaction that you're describing. But yeah, at this point, I'm not confident it would.
I'm sorry, hang on just one second. Hey, y'all, I was talking with Derek Scher from Listen and Think Audiobooks, and he agrees with me that it's so important that the Trump White House hears from large numbers of Americans who support his efforts to end the wars in Syria and Afghanistan, especially from combat veterans like himself. The president must hear voices of support from out here in the real world to counteract the cries of the war party in D.C. and on TV. Now, the phone lines are jammed, but they have a pretty good email system there at whitehouse.gov. Email me, scott@scotthorton.org, when you do, and Derek Scher at Listen and Think Audiobooks will give you two free ones for your effort. Well, there's no question that it's already a full court press by TV to discredit any of this. And of course, all the major newspapers and everything too, but they're just decided to tune into the Jake Tapper show for just a few minutes is to get a taste of this, where essentially any withdrawal from anywhere is extremely reckless and bordering on treasonous because it's all a present to Vladimir Putin because that's what he wants and this kind of thing. But on the other hand, I don't think the American people really feel that way. So I think Trump, if he was smart, maybe a little bit smarter than he is, he could end those wars and then he could play it as him and the American people and the soldiers and their families who want to end these wars versus the media who never been in a fight in their life and want this thing to continue forever and ever for nobody knows why. And if he framed it that way, you know, because he's already pits himself against the media in every context anyway. So you could just add that to it. That the worst thing about the media is they keep listening to Bill Kristol after all this time when they should have quit by now and this kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. The Russia argument, of course, is really interesting given, you know, this idea that if we get out, Russia will get in there and become so powerful. And it's so difficult to see how that argument makes sense, given what a drain responsibility for these conflicts has been on the United States over the past almost two decades. The idea that if Russia wants to get into these places, it's going to make them more powerful is hard to see. If that's a responsibility Russia wants to take on, it seems like a real possibility that in relatively short order, it would equally become a drain on Moscow in the way it's been a drain on Moscow,
right,
financially and with the loss of life and just sort of the stretching thin of military commitments.
Right. That was part of how they defeated the Soviet Union was after Vietnam, they backed off containment and in fact encouraged Soviet overexpansion in various ways, and especially in Afghanistan, to give them their own Vietnam and bog them down and bleed their treasury dry and all of that. And so why would we replicate their same failure? And why would they replicate our replication of their same failure, the Russians, this time around?
Yeah.
Good question.
It is. And it's a question that I think is not addressed often enough. And it's very related to what we were discussing about, you know, Somalia in particular, just this whether willful or unintentional ignorance of the recent history and of how things have played out, you know, not that long ago, and on this inability, it seems, to learn from that and to actually, you know, do something better and different that does not have these same outcomes.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, do you have any other more recent articles after this Somalia thing that I missed?
About Somalia in particular?
Oh, no, about anything.
Oh.
I mean, or about anything foreign policy, you know, sure. Anti-war.com-ish.
Yeah. Well, let's see. When was this Somalia? This was
in
January.
Do you have like an email list? Because I know you write for so many different places.
Yeah, I do technically have an email list. It's deeply inactive, so okay. I wouldn't really recommend that. But yeah, I write usually one to two articles through Defense Priorities each week that are placed in various outlets like Reason and elsewhere. This month has been a little slow as I've been sick and traveling, but I just had a piece come out. This is real sad that I have to look at my own Twitter to remember what I wrote.
But it's all right. I'm putting you on the spot and everything.
I just had a piece come out with Defense News about Afghanistan and the possibility of withdrawal there in light of this these recent new negotiations between the United States and the Taliban they announced, I think it was it this Monday? Yeah, this Monday that they've developed this draft for a framework that it, like, it's all very details. A lot of details still need to be worked out, but they've reached sort of tentative, like, overarching framework that would trade, among other things, U.S. withdrawal for the Taliban's pledge to keep Afghanistan from becoming, you know, a haven for terrorists. So that's, I think, a really positive development. And I wrote an article for True Defense Priorities that was published at Defense News, basically arguing, you know, these negotiations are great and should be supported. But even if they fail, you know, it's still time for us to be leaving Afghanistan. And that should be sort of the higher order priority, regardless of what happens with the talks.
Great. Yeah, I totally agree with you about that. And, you know, I saw a thing which was, I blogged it at the Libertarian Institute site, where Trump, it was, I think, Voice of America, where Trump says, Trump himself, and they said it was in a statement, but they didn't make it very clear if he said it to a reporter or whether it was a piece of paper they put out or something. But he said, the report said that he said from, you know, right now, he's absolutely willing to withdraw all troops, which is, you know, essentially all carrot and not much stick, which is fine with me. But he really, it's kind of amazing to me. You think about all of the inertia behind staying there. But he seems to have told Khalilzad, Zalmay Khalilzad, the negotiator here, that we are leaving. Your job is to save as much face as you can between now and then. But this thing is over, because, I mean, it's just amazing, actually, to see. This is one where he apparently is sticking to his guns. Although, as I say, they say he hasn't given the orders yet. But if he's got Khalilzad agreeing to what the Taliban have promised for more than 10 years now, that, of course, will keep Al-Qaeda out. That's not a problem. And that's their only condition. They're going to even drop the condition of staying at the Bagram Air Base. That has to be the president really putting his foot down against the Pentagon if they're willing to do that, because they want to keep that base so bad.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, certainly it's early days yet with this deal, but it's very far and away one of the most optimistic things happening in foreign policy right now, I think.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And the Trump administration does deserve credit for certainly there have been negotiations with the Taliban previously, started in the Obama years, but for appointing Khalilzad to this position, because it really does seem to have been a breakthrough in the talks, and we've gotten into new territory with this that we have not seen previously.
Mm-hmm. So I forget which story it was I read that said that, I guess they were going to insist, but this was really kind of face-saving, where they were going to insist on the way out, as not as a condition, or sort of as like a half a condition, I guess, that the Taliban negotiate with the Afghan government, such as it is, that they've refused to negotiate all this time. They didn't sound like they were insisting on it, quote unquote, but that it wasn't necessarily a condition of withdrawal. But you know, what's funny to me is I haven't seen anyone say that maybe they had ought to offer a deal for kind of a very strong federalism where the Taliban get to rule the whole South and East. But just as long as they promise to not sack Kabul and take over Kabul, something like that, because it seems like inviting them into the capital city in numbers that way is just going to lead to right back to civil war the way it was before. It seems kind of surprising that no one's saying, hey, what if we kind of drew soft borders where everybody is right now and just let you keep what you got and have, you know what I mean? You don't have to break up Afghanistan into pieces, but no one seems to be offering that. Everything seems to still be a question of who's going to rule the capital city and then attempt to rule the rest of the country from there, which seems to be the recipe for far more violence.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting to see where that requirement of including the Afghan government in the talks, where that comes in, at what stage, because, you know, the Afghan government and the United States are both very insistent that that happened. The Taliban still, at least publicly, is saying they don't want it. But also the question of, you know, is the Taliban going to, like, participate in the government? Like, are they going to function like a political party? It's been, that's certainly been a subject of speculation, like that there are, you know, these elements within the Taliban that are tired of violence and are ready to participate politically. But yeah, I don't know. I think to a large extent, it may simply end up being, you know, let's see what happens and how things shake out. As much as they may try to work things out one way or another in the deal, once we've actually left, you know, it could end up looking very differently from what's agreed to.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right, you guys, that's Bonnie Christian. She's a fellow at Defense Priorities and weekend editor at The Week. And she's written for all kinds of things, including the American Conservative magazine. And here she is at Reason magazine with, if Trump isn't planning to draw down U.S. intervention in Somalia, he should be. And at defensenews.com, U.S. forces should leave Afghanistan, even if a deal with the Taliban fails. All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.